rise. Court of Appeals Division 1 is now in session.
Thank you all. Please be seated. It's a time set for oral argument in our case number CACV 250759, Torres versus Reeves. Each side is allocated 20 minutes for your oral argument. Appellant, you may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal if you wish to do so. If you wish to do so, you need to keep track of your own time at the podium clock. For those in attendance, and I would ask that everyone make sure your cell phones are off so that our proceedings are not interrupted and to avoid embarrassment. We have read the briefs. We've conferenced the case. We'd encourage you to keep that in mind as you present argument today. Our proceedings are being recorded and will be posted to YouTube in due course. So please, as you begin your presentation, tell us your name and the party that you represent. With that, Ms. Freeman, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. Susan Freeman on behalf of Colin Reeves. There are benefits to moot courts. So let me start off by saying, for the court as well as for the parties, we will concede that there was sufficient proximate cause evidence for the court to find proximate cause to assess punitive damages. So we will limit our argument to the amount of the damages, which was greatly excessive here, grossly excessive. The punitive damages must be, one, constitutionally limited to a one-to-one ratio with the compensatories, because otherwise, given the substantial compensatories, that violates due process. Two, the punitive damages exceed the permissible amount given Mr. Reeves' net worth. That is an issue that the judge should have addressed post-trial and not just said, I can't deal with it because it wasn't before the jury. And the compensatory damages are excessive, exceed the tolerable limits, as our Supreme Court has used in other cases, given the non-economic harm, given the comparison to the other judgments, the other verdicts that have not been remitted, and even the remitted amounts.
Why don't we start there, Ms. Freeman?
Sure.
What is the maximum amount a jury can award for the death of a 20 and a 23-year-old?
Your Honor, I don't know. It's something that's determined by the jury, but there are tolerable limits to the amount.
And
the
court said $8 million for a human life is too much. It's beyond tolerable. Is that what you're saying?
The issue here is that the amount was determined by the jury based upon the arguments that one could look to, the amount of money that the expert earned over this course of time.
Right, how much money Dr. Pellis had earned, correct.
Correct.
Was there any objection to at the trial to that testimony about what he earned or the argument in closing argument about basing the damages on Dr. Pellis' income?
There was not, Your Honor. But the liberatory case says that this court must nonetheless reverse if the misconduct was of so serious a nature, no admonition or instructions by the court could undo the damage. What we have here, the trial court said, I didn't overrule it because the court didn't consider it as so far beyond typical that it could influence the jury. But in fact, it could, and it probably did, because when the court looks to the case law as to the test to be applied, it's whether it probably did. In the Grant case, the court said if the improper argument was directed toward punitive damages, toward retribution, toward not taking appropriate recognition as to what was done, if punitives were awarded or the compensatory amount appears at all excessive, we have no hesitation in concluding that the misconduct probably influenced the result. And here we have both punitive damages that were awarded and the compensatories that are greatly excessive compared to anything else
What are we to compare that with? Obviously, you have the jury verdict forms, the Westlaw reports, or the trial reporter that
right.
we used to get when I was in practice that
right.
would tell you what the verdicts were. Is that a representative sample from which we can derive what a proper verdict is for in a wrongful death case? Because, I mean, when you think about it, the cases that go to trial are, in some senses, outliers. It's where, if you've got $1 million policy, for instance, and the damages are $5 million, that's going to be settled. That's not going to be something that's going to show up in a trial report. It's those unusual cases where you have very egregious facts, or you have sufficient coverage, or some other way to collect that is going to a verdict. So when you look at the reports that you get from the trial report, they're not truly representative of what a wrongful death claim is worth. It is one data point, but you can't simply say, oh, well, we don't have a recorded verdict in this amount, and therefore this one must be excessive. Would you address that, please?
Your Honor, this is the list of what juries award. Mm-hmm. It's not what counsel thinks or the insurance adjuster might think. This is what juries award. And the juries that have awarded amounts that are significantly less than the amounts awarded here have been remitted by the
courts. Some of them have. I'm old enough to remember value options. Value options stood up on appeal. That was $11 million for a human life.
And is that one of the ones that I had listed here? I think it is. But there were explanations with respect to each of those. Did it have the economic damages as part of it, so that you're determining? I think it was 50,000 of the, whatever the amount was in fact determined based upon economic damages. We don't have any of that here. This is just pain and suffering. Pain and suffering is a lot. No question. But I would urge the court to look at the Gregory case, where the Texas Supreme Court is saying, how do we determine what's the value of a human life? What's the value of just pain and suffering? And what the court said is you have to look at what evidence there is as to the amount that it should be. And in that case, as here, there was the plaintiffs individually saying, we have suffered this. Our children were wonderful. The opponent was awful. And we've lost that. But we don't have anything beyond that. No medical expenses, nothing more than that. And what we do have on top of that is, in that case, the argument that the amount, not the award, not giving the award, but the amount should be determined by however many cents per mile that this company, which was a trucking company, traveled per year. That's not an appropriate basis to determine it. And that's what the jury had in mind.
How is a plaintiff's lawyer to argue wrongful death damages in a case like this, where we don't have medical expenses, but it's not a circumstance where we have someone who's profoundly injured and is going to require medical treatment for decades to come? What we have here is the loss of three parents of their young children. Do we not confer that decision of what that's worth to a jury?
We do confer it to the jury, but as the court has said, there are tolerable limits to what is the amount.
So what is the tolerable limit?
Here, I can't tell you. I would say if this was a $5 million case total, this would be a lot harder argument for me to make, no question. But $90 million?
We're talking about compensatory damages, aren't we?
Okay.
I mean, I understand we have
right.
the punitives we need to talk about, but in terms of the compensatory damages for the wrongful death,
right.
$8 million for each of the three plaintiffs here. In your view, that is clearly excessive such that this court should intervene and reduce that. Is that your argument?
My argument, Your Honor, is that you need to look at Desert Palm, the PETA, where the court said $11 million for two plaintiffs was too much in circumstances like this. And that's what the Supreme Court in Soto quoted and said, yes, this is good law. This is good law that we should look at.
And
how
Ms.
do you
Freeman,
determine it?
For this issue, and I get
yes.
that we will turn to others
mm-hmm.
soon, that's purely a question of Arizona state law. Right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I guess I would add, though, the comment from the U.S. Supreme Court in that Exxon Valdez case. I think it was focusing mostly on punitive damages, though, but in determining that.
And a very different case than a wrongful death.
But it was saying, you know, damages should be, I guess, within an acceptable range, a range that people can look at and say when they're trying to settle a case, when the judge are looking at. But yes.
Some predictability. But I just want to understand your point. It on the compensatory damages, I understood the briefs and your argument today to be purely under Arizona law, not directed by the United States Constitution.
That is correct. Not directed by the U.S. Constitution, except that, you know, the trial court said, I'm just going to leave this to the jury. You know, I'm not going to step in and overlook the jury. And when you look at the cases on this, like Desert Palm v. Pitta, the judge didn't say, I find no passion and prejudice here. He just said, I'm not going to look at what the jury said. And this court, the court is supposed to look at what the jury said. The court is supposed to engage with these comparatives, not just say, you know, not persuasive, didn't say, as I said, no passion and prejudice, just, I'm not going to look at this.
And I understand that, but that was the judge that sat through the trial, that
correct.
Saw the witnesses,
correct.
Knew the jury, and said, no, I'm going to leave this intact. And we are, wasn't in the jury room deliberating, I
right.
get that. But we're one step further removed, that it comes to us on the cold record. We did not see the witnesses testify. We did not see the jurors work. We did not see the jurors provide questions. We did
correct.
Not see closing arguments.
I understand, Your Honor. But, you know, you still need to address whether the court met the statutory, the limits, met the requirements of looking seriously at comparatives. Maybe just said, under this case, this is so different than all of these others, you know, that it's appropriate here.
And I understand your position. I also
okay.
understand time goes fast. And
okay.
you identified two other issues, the I'll call it the net worth question, and then the
can
punitive
I ask one
damage.
Question, though,
of course,
just,
of course.
It does seem like a very large amount, but I haven't heard you say what is the acceptable range. You're saying we should conclude that it's too much, but by how much?
When one looks at the acceptable range, and one looks at the only comparatives that, you know, both sides could come up with, and we put them in order, most of the cases that are similar to this are in the range of $500,000 for a plaintiff. The high range would
that's
be $1.5 million. That's the high side. So
of compensatory,
of compensatory, okay. of compensatory alone. The damages were excessive compared to his net worth. The one-to-one is not really a protection for the ordinary person. Usually, the plaintiff would try to make a prima facie case for punitive damages, and then would get discovery on that, and would produce it. They didn't ask for that here.
Why not plead the poverty defense? I mean, you've got a client who's, I'm assuming, was not worth $90 million. Why didn't your side put that evidence in and say, look, these are the only assets he has, so you obviously, you can't, as we say, financially destroy him. You can't wipe him out. Why didn't your side put that evidence in, and why shouldn't we treat your side's failure to do so as waiver of that issue?
Okay, two answers to that. One, Your Honor, that was prior counsel, and by the time current counsel who tried the case came in, there was nothing to be done. So I don't know the answer to that. But two, I guess kind of three answers to this. If you look at Hawkins and Neenanstadt, they said that the evidence of their net worth is not required. But Hawkins also went on to say, while the plaintiff is not required to put on evidence of wealth, citing Neenstadt, the plaintiff must produce evidence that the amount may not be said to be so unreasonable in regard to the circumstances as to show passion and prejudice. That's the plaintiff's burden. The plaintiff's, not the defendant's. And, you know, the more we talked about this and thought about it, this really, due process of law, determination being not excessive, that's not an affirmative defense. That's not a defense at all. That's the plaintiff made the strategic choice, all right, we're not going to tell the jury that, and so we...
Well, I mean, your side kind of made a strategic choice, too, didn't you? I mean, there was certainly nothing preventing you, and I understand it was not you. I understand it was prior counsel. But there was certainly nothing preventing the defendant here from saying, look, I don't own that much. You can't be asking for these huge numbers.
It does not. Nonetheless, even if you don't have that, if you don't have that evidence, the court is still required to look at it and see if the amount is so excessive that it you know, takes this into account. I would cite to the court Arizona Rule of Evidence 103E, that the court may take notice of error affecting fundamental rights, even if they are not preserved. So even if it wasn't preserved here, due process was a pretty fundamental right.
Let me ask. It strikes me that passion and prejudice has been an inquiry since kind of time began in reviewing jury verdicts. The net worth of a defendant to assess the constitutionality of punitive damages is a comparatively recent advent. Those seem like different inquiries.
You know, I don't think that that's necessarily the case, Your Honor. And I would look at Hawkins and look at some of the earlier cases in terms of the court saying that, and even the Supreme Court saying the amount of the damages, the disproportionality is one of the factors that the court considers in determining whether this was a grossly excessive verdict that accounts for passion, that demonstrates passion and prejudice. So Hawkins is coming up with saying passion and prejudice, and this is one of the factors, and we don't have it in this particular case because the amount was not excessive. But Hawkins is saying you still can't financially kill the defendant, and you do need to look at this.
But if the jury's not given any competent evidential matter to make that call,
then it's still the court's obligation. If a court should look at page 48 of the answering brief, it says exclusion of DUI evidence at trial doesn't preclude consideration as a due process factor because post-trial due process reviews by the court. That's the court's obligation.
And I get that, but doesn't that, particularly in a state like Arizona with a strong constitution that preserves the work of the jury, we honor jury verdicts with some limits, for sure, and you're arguing one of those.
And that is one of the limits.
But to Judge Beck's point, is it really fair then say that the trial court erred when there was no evidence offered by the defendant?
Because we gave that no, there was no evidence before the jury, but we gave that evidence to the court in the new trial motion. So the court had that.
I understand that, but that strikes me as a little bit late.
Well, you know, I cited U.S. Supreme Court case law saying that no, it's not.
Okay.
You know, that's part of due process, is that you have not just a jury making decisions, but you have the trial court that gives a second look, and then you have the appellate court.
But is it a second look if the jury doesn't get the first look?
If the jury doesn't get the first look, but then awards damages that are so far out of line, you know, $79 million? That's so far ahead of anything else. Anywhere, I mean, as I said, if it was $5 million, you know, we wouldn't have much of an argument. But $79 million? That is so far out of line to show that it really was passion and prejudice. And I see I only have 3 minutes left, if I may reserve the remainder of my time.
Would you be amenable to giving Ms. Freeman 5 more minutes and 5 more minutes for the other side? I would like to hear a little bit more about your proportionality argument, specifically the ratio of the punitive damages to the compensatory damages, if we could give a little more time.
Will do that. We'll give each side 5 additional minutes.
The punitive, not the one-to-one ratio part? But,
correct. Yes. No, I'd like to hear from you a little bit about why we haven't really spent a lot of time talking about the ratio of the punitive damages with respect to the compensatory damages, and I'd like to hear a little more from
you. Sure. I would point the court to Smith v. Olson, the most recent decision by this court, looking at State Farm and saying when the compensatories are substantial, and substantial was set at $500,000, then you must do a one-to-one ratio. And I would say every single reported case, the ones that are not the unreported and with significantly lower amounts, but all of the reported cases with anything in that range or above, and that would be Nardelli, Pope, Olson, Hudgens, that the court has always said that that should be the amount.
Well, Smith v. Olson's a bit different, isn't it? I mean, the harm that was inflicted in Smith v. Olson was, you know, intentional infliction of emotional distress, obviously intentional conduct, mm-hmm. But the damages that were sustained were emotional, if you will, as opposed to the death of two human beings. How do we balance those two factors where we have, in one case, we have emotional damages but intentional conduct, and in this case, we have highly reckless conduct but not intentional, but we have extreme damages in the form of human lives. Could you address that,
please? And both of those get you to reprehensibility. Both of those get you to reprehensibility. You then look at the factor of the comparative civil and even criminal penalties, and they are significantly lower. And I would point the court specifically to $150,000 is the top amount that you're going to get for a felony conviction in terms of
what criminal penalties should we be looking at? What crime was committed by your client, as opposed to what he pled to?
Sure. It was $150,000 for any felony was what I had found in looking at this. But in any event, none of them are close to the $79 million, which we have here. Nothing even comparative, nothing close at all. The Supreme Court had said you look at treble damages statutes to determine, say, all right, well, it should be single digit instead of double or triple digits. But then after that, the court said, if it's substantial compensatory damages, you still have a one-to-one limit. So,
well, is that the language that the Supreme Court used?
I'm probably paraphrasing. It did.
Didn't
use
it
words.
Say perhaps a limit of one-to-one is the maximum? Perhaps.
Yes. And then every single Arizona case has used that as the maximum. And I don't know of any other U.S. Supreme Court cases that have done anything other than that.
Certainly other states in interpreting and applying both Gore and State Farm have okayed or have affirmed in cases where you have more than a one-to-one ratio with substantial compensatory damages. Isn't that correct?
They had cited several. I responded on each of those and showed how that they are different than ours in our briefs. So we'll go back through all of those and you can look at it yourself. But the point would be that whenever you have substantial, and no question, you know, 8 million, 7.21 or 7.4 is substantial. Whenever you have substantial, it's the one-to-one ratio. May I reserve the remainder?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Artique.
Good morning. Cameron Artique for the Appalese. With me at the council table is trial counsel for Zoe Torres and Chris and Shannon Dillard. I will discuss the issues in the same order that they were discussed by Ms. Freeman. That's probably logically, it'll keep things logical. Let me start with Judge Beck's question on what is the price of a human life. It sounds like a rhetorical question. It gets asked all the time. The pertinent point for today's proceeding is that this is quintessentially a jury thing. You have two different levels of discretion and deference operating here. Out of all the different damages determinations that are made by juries under the law, valuing non-economic damages in a wrongful death case is at the very tippy top of what is hard to value. And because there's no metric, there's no arithmetic you can do. You have crying and boxes of tissues and broken dreams and all this kind of thing, and that is the jury's job. And that's one level of deference. The second level of deference is, of course, accorded to the trial court, who sat through the trial and said, no reason to disturb this verdict. Now, the argument past that point is one of comparing apples and oranges and other kinds of fruits.
Well, what about the comparing wrongful death damages to how much money the defendant's expert witness makes in a year? Is that an appropriate argument? Is that something that a jury should be encouraged to be comparing?
No, that's not a pertinent comparison, Your Honor. And if you look at the trial transcript as a whole, the jury was instructed as to how to measure damages. Counsel walked through that instruction carefully, spent 10 pages walking through that instruction. The damages evidence was so potent and so obvious, they didn't litigate the issue. They didn't call a witness. They didn't ask a single question. And to say, well, the jury didn't...
There weren't a lot of good questions to ask on the defense side in this case, was there, Mr. Arkin?
Well, you said it, Your Honor. I didn't.
This is a tough case to defend, is it not?
It's a tough case to defend, indeed. But the idea that counsel would say, oh, well, how are we going to get the jury to award damages? It's not the pain and suffering and anguish and distress that the jury has been instructed to base their damages award on. It's Dr. Pellis's income. That is not what happened. And on top of all that, there's no objection made. I mean, if an objection is made, the trial court can do any number of things. You know, sidebar, curative instruction, reformulate. And you can cure it in the moment. Here,
understanding there was no objection. Is it an improper argument in closing argument, in your view?
No, I think when you consider the transcript as a whole, Your Honor, I don't think it's an improper argument because counsel was not arguing, please measure damages by the amount the expert witness was paid. Because that wasn't even an $8 million figure. I mean, it was like he was paid $40,000 for this case and he makes a good living. That goes to the if I may call it, the dance monkey point, that this expert delivers the opinions that are desired by the party who's hiring him. That goes to the expert's pecuniary interest, and that's fair advocacy. And the trial judge also said, hey, you didn't make an objection, it's waived, and even if you'd made the objection, I was in the room, and I think this is fair advocacy. Now, Ms. Freeman mentioned the Liberatore case, which was cited in the reply brief, for the proposition that, you don't need to make an objection during your closing argument. In that case, there's a motion in limine that is made and granted before trial. The court says, that adequately preserves the objection. And there was a timely mistrial motion made. So you don't need to make the objection during argument if you've made a timely motion in limine and a timely motion for mistrial. None of that happened here.
Could you address your friend's point about comparable verdicts?
Yes.
Are there comparable Arizona verdicts from which we can say that this is in the range?
Index of record 167, Exhibit A, we supplied the trial court with 12 comparable wrongful death verdicts. One was from Tucson, two were in federal court, 9 were from Maricopa County Superior Court. The damages for loss of a child were $6 million, $10 million, $13 million, and $15 million. And the $6 million figure was 20 years old. So this is in the mainstream. This is in the heartland of what the loss of an adult child is worth. And there's just no basis for the court to disturb that.
And all of those were simply compensatory damages, not no medical, any other.
Correct. I don't know whether there's specials involved. They were wrongful death cases, which I sounds coarse, but usually wrongful deaths happen quickly, so the specials are less.
Is there some amount that you would view to be excessive that would warrant either the Superior Court or this court stepping in and saying that's too much?
If it was $1 billion, sure. If it was $500 million, sure. But when it's in the mainstream of every case we cited, in the Ahmad case, it was 30, and it was remitted to 10, and this court said that was an abuse of discretion. So this is like a fraction of the Ahmad verdict. There's no basis to set this aside.
What about the point Ms. Freeman made about there was evidence of the net worth that was presented to the trial court.
What, you know, would that we were here with a totally different advocacy and a totally different record, this would be an interesting issue to unpack. Like, whatever happened to wealth? Because it was dropped from the RAJIs. It used to be important, and then it just dropped out. And clear, what usually happens is the plaintiffs are suing the railroad or the wealthy landowner, and the plaintiffs want to provide evidence of the wealth of the defendant. Here you have the opposite. How that shakes out, I frankly don't know. But here, you couldn't have more waiver. It wasn't preserved in the pretrial. No jury instruction was requested. No evidence was offered. I mean, why isn't Colin Reeves asked on cross, how much money's in your checking account? He's never asked. Is an offer of proof made? No, it is not. What happened instead? On August 21st, on page 80 of the transcript, Ms. Freeman went to the trial court judge and said, we withdraw this argument. Now, when you don't do anything to preserve or litigate an argument, and you go to the trial judge and say, I hereby withdraw it, I ain't making this argument anymore, you're done. And you can't just submit a declaration with your Rule 59 motion and say, oh, well, now we'd like to make this argument. You're done. And so that's all I have to say about that issue.
Can you point us to a similar case where we have a defendant who elects, I think in this case, not to press that poverty defense and then comes back after the facts in a post-trial motion and tries to make an argument that my net worth should be considered?
No such case, Your Honor. Okay. No such case. I can't find it. It's never happened. And I don't know what else you could do beyond going to the trial judge and saying, I'm going to withdraw this argument and the trial will proceed based on that basis. Let me finally talk about the punitive damages.
Yeah, could you go specifically to cases that support your view that you can, when there are significant compensatory damages, it can be more than a one-to-one ratio?
Yes. I would point you towards Knasek versus George Johnson, 2022. Where the punitive damages are awarded at a ratio of 3-to-1. Supervisor Knasek is deprived of an interest in a trust through malicious breach of fiduciary duty, bad conduct. It's a multi-million dollar compensatory damages award, and the punitives are awarded at 3-to-1 and affirmed in 2022. And the law under State Farm versus the Due Process Clause hasn't changed a bit since 2022.
Can you address Smith v. Olson, which went kind of the other way, where we had you had a ratio that was greater than 1-to-1, and that this court remitted it to 1-to-1?
Yeah, I mean, I guess all I can say, Judge Beck, is that, you know, these cases are all unique, you know, and that there is an inherent hazard in comparing, you know, the going through the whole fruit aisle and comparing every kind of fruit. I think you're overreading, or anyone is overreading that case to say, well, in Arizona, our determination is that the Due Process Clause has a hard cap of 1-to-1. That's not the Knasek case. That's not the Soto versus Ten Bridges, which is an even more recent case. It's an unpublished memo decision. But that was affirmed at 3-to-1.
And was that intentional?
That was fraud. That was fraud. Okay. That's right.
Is there a difference where this is gross negligence, but it doesn't seem to be intentional conduct?
Well, you know, Judge, it's not murder. It's not intentional homicide. But you never get that case in a wrongful death context because there's no insurance policy that insures intentional homicide. So, you know, in order to trigger coverage, it has to have this sort of conscious disregard of a risk mental state to preserve potential insurance coverage. There's just, you know, and so if you say, well, we only get really bad multiples going when it's intentional homicide, well, then unless you're O.J. Simpson.
But it doesn't have to be homicide. But I thought one of the premises underlying punitives are we want to discourage this type of conduct, and we tend to discourage intentional acts as opposed to negligence?
Yeah, I guess I'd point you back to the Supreme Court's recent decision on the whole punitive damages doctrine, the Swift trucking case, where the Supreme Court says kind of the marquee, the classic metric for punitive damages is the criminal recklessness standard under Title 13. And that's what we have here. That's what he pled guilty to. So the Supreme Court says, yeah, the kind of mental state, the culpable mental state we have in mind to impose punitive damages is criminal recklessness. And that was pled to here.
But imposing them is different than imposing them at a 3-to-1 ratio as opposed to a 1-to-1.
Yeah, I guess, you know, Mr. Reeves is the appellant who has the burden of proving error. So I think it's fair to ask, show me a wrongful death case where 2.75 to 1 has been too high. Show me any case from anywhere at any time. Show me a wrongful death case.
So is that based on the gravity of the harm or the reprehensibility of the conduct, which is the discussion I had with your friend particularly in comparing it to Smith v. Olson. Smith v. Olson, the conduct was intentional as opposed to reckless, albeit the harm was substantially greater or obviously a death of a human being as opposed to emotional harm. How do we weigh those two factors?
That's a great question. And, you know, once you get into this moral calculus stuff, it does get very, very difficult. That's why there are these factors under the reprehensibility. Reprehensibility is the most important thing. It's more important than ratio. That's what the Supreme Court said. Reprehensibility is the most important guidepost. Causing death of whatever mental state has to be more reprehensible than defrauding someone.
But your client might have, your opponent might have injured someone as opposed to killing them. Isn't the reprehensibility the conduct as opposed to the result of the conduct?
No, the reprehensibility is, and I'm sorry, Judge, you're kind of making me sort of do the jury thing again, but the reprehensibility here is to have a habit of drinking and driving for years and years and years and carrying around a plastic cup to urinate into because you don't feel like using the bathroom because that's inconvenient, and then killing people while you're speeding and running through a red light and taking your eyes off the road because you're trying to urinate. That's what's outrageous. That's what's reprehensible.
The allegation was it was actually urinating while going through the intersection, as opposed to sometime earlier.
Well, he testified that this was his practice, to urinate in a cup so he didn't have to use the bathroom. He says on the body cam footage to Sergeant Williams, he says, that urine in the cup, that was my son's urine. Sergeant Williams says, well, that was strange because his son wasn't there. And then he says on the stand, he's asked, well, that when you told Sergeant Williams that was your son's urine, that was a lie, wasn't it? And he says, yeah, it was a lie. So it wasn't hard for the jury to figure out whose urine was in the cup.
That could have been from 10 minutes earlier. I'm not sure where that goes to the conduct in running through the intersection.
Well, it could have been from 10. That's for the jury to resolve. His zipper was still down. If it was 10 minutes earlier, he hadn't bothered to zip up his fly. This is jury stuff. You do have to ask, why didn't he ever touch the brakes? He had 4 seconds to stop. The brakes are never engaged. Obviously, the driver isn't looking at the road ahead. That's part of what makes this outrageous and unfortunate. You know, this is, beneath the fatalities, this is a pretty ordinary car crash. One car going straight, one car turning left. It's the intoxication and the speeding the truck, you know, with the possibility.
This wasn't 90 miles an hour. This was around 10 miles an hour.
That's right. The speeding is kind of the least outrageous aspect of it. It's the red light running and taking your eyes off the road that is.
Right, but without the drinking. There are accidents that happen. People run a red light. You certainly don't get there with There's two deaths. Someone ran a red light going 8 miles over the speed limit. It doesn't result in...
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. And that's what the Belliard case says, and that's what's in the Rajis, is it's the alcohol is what unlocks the punitive damages instruction. That's just the way the law works. And it was undisputed here.
Mr. Archie, would you address your friend's point about the comparable fines for the criminal conduct, the third Gore guidepost?
Yeah. There's not an extensive case law on this. I cited a case that says this is the least important guidepost. The Supreme Court, when they articulated these, was trying to protect, you know, insurance companies, manufacturers, and there are certain regulatory contexts where, like the Department of Insurance can say, oh, if you're cheating an insured customer, we'll, you know, the civil fine is $50,000. So there are circumstances in which you can say, hey, I'm a corporation, my kind of estimation of the cost of doing business is this, and that's a relevant benchmark. Here, as I said, it's under Title 13. There's just ADOT doesn't causing a fatality is just outside the civil jurisdiction of the Department of Transportation. That doesn't show that it's not very bad. It shows how bad it is. They don't give you points.
The maximum fine is, as your friend states, $150,000. Do we take that into account when thinking about the punitive damages?
No. Look, the due process issue is not just this kind of vague due process issue in a vacuum that lets this court kind of redo the punitive damages. There's a specific question presented. It's a question of fair notice. Has Mr. Reeves been deprived of due process because nobody told, he never received notice that driving while intoxicated could subject you to major punitive damages? It's an issue of did you receive fair notice, as so many due process issues are. And when the Supreme Court develops this and it's, you know, did BMW design the right gas cap on their car? They've got a sort of, hey, this was not something we ever thought about when we're hit with a $20 billion in punitive damages because of a decision an automotive engineer made. But all of us in this room who have driver's licenses know that if you drink 6 beers and going out and you're not paying attention and running red lights, you're exposed in a big way, and that is not, you can't claim ignorance of that. And so due process does not step in to protect you in those, and that's, like, I guess I'm restating the reprehensibility thing. It is remarkable that in 30 years, there is no Arizona published opinion, there is no Arizona memo decision involving a death, that all the Arizona precedents are fraud, insurance bad faith, mean and hostile.
Graham via value options.
Well, yeah, okay. Yes. Fair point. But this is two deaths, and this is an outlier, and the jury was entitled to consider an outlier.
But could I ask if you, just going back to the hypothetical where there's no alcohol involved, it's an accident. Compensatory damages.
Yes.
Would it be an excessive verdict if it's $8 million in compensatory damages? Just 8 miles an hour over the speed limit, run a red light, and kill two people each. Compensatories of... It seems like the alcohol contributes to the compensatory number. Is that...
Oh, I don't think so. The alcohol has nothing to do with the comparable verdicts we submitted. That's punitive damages is a separate issue. There was no alcohol in Ahmad versus State. That was just a police, high-speed police pursuit, and the damages were 30. I don't think there's any basis for saying that alcohol had to deal with the eight. Eight is, it sounds so callous, but eight is what you give a parent who's lost a child in a sudden vehicle fatality, or at least it's within the discretion that a jury can decide I mean, that is a normal result. It is simply not for an appellate court to say not, and it's 8 multiplied by comparative fault. I mean, the jury allocated fault here, 12% to Audrey, 88% to Reeves, in the issue that they withdrew this morning. So it's 8 deducted by the comparative fault. You can't upset that verdict. I mean, that's what juries do. Unless there are more questions, I'm going to retire.
Thank you. Ms. Freeman, rebuttal.
Okay, try to go through this quickly. Number one, he said we didn't introduce evidence. We tried to introduce the evidence as to his net worth, and they objected, saying nothing in discovery, therefore you can't introduce it. So it did
And then your side said we withdraw the poverty
defense. Because there was no evidence or no discovery, and so we recognized that there would be asking the jury to speculate. The comparative amount is in fact in RAJI 4. It got taken out because of the lack of evidence and not wanting the jury to speculate, but it's not dropped from the RAJIs. Instead, the RAJI says this is an issue for the court to determine as to due process. That's a constitutional issue. So it's still in there. We did try to, Judge Catani, the Exhibit A to our motion for new trial does go through all of the comparatives and explains them and explains the amount of where we do have or do not have the amount of the economic damages. I would note in the value options case that while there was $11 million in punitive damages, 2 of the plaintiffs got $500,000, 2 got $2.5 million, and 1 got $5 million. None of them were getting $8 million.
How long ago was value options, Ms. Freeman?
That was in 2008. And in that case, the court, and then in terms of the Kunicek case that he's comparing it to, the total punitive damages were 1-to-1. The total punitive damages to the total compensatory damages were 1-to-1. It was that one of the defendants' individual share was 3 times his share of the compensatory award, given his intentional malice, particularly egregious role, and significant wealth. That was why he got more than a 1-to-1. So.
And was that constitutional?
That it was limited to 1-to-1? Oh,
well, no.
Particular instance?
For that, would you argue?
I would note that this is not a published decision, and it doesn't meet the criteria of being persuasive.
Understood, but was an award of 3-to-1 with that, given the reprehensibility of that particular defendant in Kunicek, in your view, was that unconstitutional? Was that a violation of the due process clause?
Yes, I would say it was, but especially given his significant wealth, and that was why he had more, which we certainly do not have here. Here we have reprehensibility, no question, but this harping on that he was peeing in a cup. There was no cup in evidence. There was no cup that was there. There was no discussion about that. Yes, we've dropped that argument because we recognize there was a basis for the jury to find that running the red light was enough, not the speed, but you have that. So we're not arguing that. But the point is, when there's so much, these are wonderful students, and here's this guy who's driving through the intersection, not looking, no evidence that he wasn't looking. What we have is a...
If he doesn't brake and doesn't attempt to evade, isn't that evidence he wasn't looking?
But he didn't see, there would be no way to see that this person is turning in front of him until she actually turns. She's 4.5 seconds, she's at the back at the intersection. You're going forward, looking forward until you actually turn to the left, then you might look only to the left. But until she actually starts to turn, then he's not going to see her coming across his viewpoint. So in a normal situation, if you didn't have the alcohol that the jury could look at, you wouldn't say that this would be a basis for punitive damages. But we do have that here. But because of that, so much hyping on that, and they're not just saying, pay attention to the particular grief. They're saying, waive the compensatory damages to even the scales with the amount that their expert made. That's how you determine. They asked for $10,000, they asked for 22 in punitives, and said you could award up to 30. They awarded a total of 30. 22 in punitives, exactly what they asked for, and they cut the compensatories a little bit down to 8. And that's not different than that happens in Hawkins and some of these other cases where it's a slight difference in the amount. I think I'm out of time.
You are, Ms. Freeman.
Okay.
Thank you. Time moves quickly. Thank you, counsel, for your presentation today. Thank you for your briefing. We will take the matter under advisement, and we'll issue a written ruling in due course. Court's adjourned.